the next number of weeks, we will actually be doing anatomy. Okay, so as I said, I had you bring your skull today, and we'll be moving through. I'll be reminding you every week of what you need to bring. Remember, I told you the anatomy, you know, it goes like this: skull, bones, joints, muscles, spine, a bit of spine, neck, bones, joints, muscles, thoracic spine, bones, joints, muscles, sternum, ribs, thorax, and then lumbar spine, bones, joints, muscles, and then sacral, so the sacrum, and a little bit of the joint between the sacrum and the ilium of the pelvis, and then we're done anatomy. Okay, that's what we need to get through. It's easy. Piece of cake. Okay, so let's talk about a little more about muscles. We're almost done. So we said last week that, you know, when myofibers shorten, we call that a contraction. So, you know, we think of, again, long head biceps. It finds an attachment in the shoulder, goes down into the forearm. So therefore, when the muscle contracts and the muscle shortens, the forearm comes closer to the shoulder, right? And we call that a contraction. So we have to look at the types of contractions that are out there. And the first is called an isotonic contraction. And traditionally, we think of an isotonic contraction is increase in tension as the muscle shortens. So that can be any muscle you can think of. In other words, when we talk about a muscle shortening, we say that the one attachment gets closer to the other attachment, whatever that movement is. Now, I haven't really gotten into dumb muscles yet, have I? Okay. Yeah, muscles are dumb. Muscles are stupid, right? They just, the nervous system says, sends a message and says contract, and the muscle says okay, and it shortens, right? So traditionally, two attachments, a message comes from the nervous system, the muscle contracts, and the two ends get closer together. So, riddle me this. Why do we say a muscle is an external rotator, or a flexor, or an extender, or an abductor?
Where it is on the bone.
Good. In what way?
So, like, the bicep would be an
flexor?
Flexor. Okay.
The elbow joint? Why? Okay, but what influence has it got? Because where's the movement in the joint in an elbow in a biceps curl? The elbow.
Yeah.
Okay, so we learned a rule last week. A muscle can only affect the joint if it crosses it. Correct?
Yeah.
Okay. The second thing is the relationship of the muscle to the axis of the movement has a direct effect on the movement that happens. Okay, so we'll do this. Gonna make a square down here. And a circle here. Now, within that circle, we have an axis of movement. Okay? In other words, this circle will spin about that axis. Everybody follow me so far? Yes? Okay. If we have muscle A that goes from here and attaches there, what movement is going to occur at that circle? Someone want to come up and draw it? Come on. Someone come up and draw the spin.
So this muscle is connecting here and here.
Yeah. Yep.
So when this muscle contracts, is the circle moves this way?
Correct. Okay. So the muscle will move in this direction. Why? Because of the attachment points in relationship to the axis, right? Yes? So far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're going to put muscle B in. It's kind of similar, isn't it? We'll just use purple here. Okay, muscle B goes this way. What direction is the spin going to go? Right? Would it be clockwise or counterclockwise? Right. So muscle B would spin it this way. Again, the muscle crosses the joint and you see the relationship of the muscle to the axis of movement, which results in whatever movement's occurring. Now, if I draw a shoulder, so I'll do a little humerus here, and then we'll do a scapula for all intents and purposes. We're not going to get fancy about it. Okay, so we have a scapula. If we have a muscle that starts here, okay, and we have a belly here, and the muscle belly is like that, what is the net movement that's going to occur when that muscle contracts? So this is medial, this is lateral. What's the name of the movement that would occur there? Sorry, I'm correct. Abduction. So you can see that here is the axis of movement, and because of the relationship of the muscle to the axis, we get abduction. Now, what would happen if I had a muscle that attached here and it contracted? What movement would we get? Adduction. Again, it crosses the joint, which is what we need. And because it is below the axis, it pulls the arm in. So muscle A is superior to the axis, and you can see its relationship to the axis. So it abducts. And muscle B, it arises from below, and because it attaches medially on the proximal humerus, we get adduction. So this is what I mean when I say a muscle is stupid. It just contracts. It is, again, structure governs function. Where a muscle is laid down in relationship to the axis of movement is its complete reason why it does what it does. So when I'm teaching you about muscles, there's going to be occasional muscles when I'm going to say muscle A, it attaches here, it attaches there, and it's an internal rotator and an abductor of the leg, and you're going to go, I don't see how it crosses the joint to cause that. Because I make these quite obvious. The angles here are quite large, right, in the relationship. For example, you know, you might have a muscle that arises here anteriorly in the pelvis and has to come back here to the hip, and it looks like it's straight across, but it's actually back a little bit that causes internal rotation, right? So it's all about how the muscle relates to the axis in the relationship between the two bones of the joint. So a muscle must cross a joint in order to affect it, and then it has its relationship to the axis. Now, we talked about the shoulder there a couple of weeks ago. How many axes were in the joint, shoulder joint? Three, correct. There were three axes, right? There was one through the front here for abduction, okay? There was one here on the side for flexion and extension, and then one down the top for internal and external rotation. That means if that joint does all those movements, we have various muscles crossing various axes to perform the tasks that the joint does. So that means, sorry? So we have three axes. One, two, and three. That means we have various muscles that cross those axes. So anything from the front, internal rotation. Anything from the back, external rotation. Anything from the top, abduction. Anything from the bottom, adduction. Anything from the front, flexion. Anything from the back, extension. They cross those three axes at different points to have that influence that relationship to the axes of movement. It'll make a bit more sense when we actually get into the pure muscles, but that's ultimately what muscles do. It's how they relate to the axes that causes the movement that they do, flexion or extension, AB or AD, internal, external rotation. It doesn't matter. It's how the muscle relates to the joint and the axis. Okay? All right. So, eccentric. Again, we said the muscles, when they shorten, the two attachments get closer together. If the muscle contraction has the two attachments get closer together and the muscle shortens, that is an isotonic concentric contraction. The muscle tension produced, which results in muscle shortening. Okay? Let's use an arm curl. So go back to an arm curl. So I have an arm curl. A concentric contraction, I'm bringing the bar up. What happens when I control the bar down? That is known as an eccentric contraction. I still have movement, but rather than shortening the muscle, I'm controlling the lengthening of a muscle. Okay, this is known as an eccentric isotonic contraction. In other words, the muscle tension produced as the muscle gets longer or elongates. In the gym, this is known as negative work, whereas shortening is known as positive work. Which of the two is best for building strength? Eccentric work, and nobody does it. Yes. Is an eccentric contraction. Is a concentric contraction. Because biceps gets shorter here and longer there. Shorter is, right, but it's no longer called negative work. For this course, it's called an eccentric contraction. Okay? Yeah, it's funny. It's proven beyond the shadow of a doubt that eccentric work makes you stronger, and barely anybody does it in the gym. Everybody's always doing concentric work, right? No. You get greater gains with eccentric work, always. Always, always, always. Also, gives you the sorest muscles is negative work. Trust me, I'm going to change all you guys in the gym by the time I'm done with you guys. I go in the gym and I look around and I'm like, yee, yikes, why is he doing that? Okay, so you can see here, this is, the angle is changing, so this is getting small, so this is flexion. And in the case of long head biceps, the muscle is shortening, so it is concentric contraction. In this side, we get extension at the elbow, which the angle is getting larger, and it's being controlled by biceps, so this is an eccentric contraction, elongation control. Now, in normal dynamic movements, okay, so I'm just walking, okay? When I walk, muscles are concentrically contracting, which brings my leg forward, okay? How many people here, when they walk in the house, somebody says, holy crap, because it's like, gung, 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 gung. Yes? Okay, that's because you have weak hamstrings. Because when we swing forward for our heel to strike, hamstrings have to eccentrically contract to control the movement so that the heel strikes. How many people here walk like this? Your feet are slapping down. Right? Tibialis anterior is weak because when we walk, when I heel strike, as I move forward, my foot wants to come down to the floor, which is appropriate, but tibialis anterior eccentrically contracts, which controls the foot nicely down to the floor so we can walk accordingly. So we tend to use these examples from a gym perspective, but in actual fact, from a functional perspective, you have eccentric and concentric contractions happening all the time. All the time. Okay, and what's really cool about that, which will speak to what's going to happen in the second half, the brain is controlling both at the same time. So it's having those movements occur at the same time. And the third thing is happening in the brain. It's actually inhibiting some muscles so they can't contract at all. And you don't have a clue it's even happening. You're just walking. For you to do this, the brain has to shut down the tricep. Tricep cannot contract, because if they both contracted at the same time, you wouldn't get any movement, because the bicep would be fighting the tricep and nothing moves. So for you to shorten biceps, the brain needs to inhibit triceps so that you get the movement. That's all the second half. And nothing happens, which means that that is an isometric contraction. So when you, an isometric contraction is muscle tension without movement. So when we talked about concentric and eccentric, it was muscle contraction with movement, whether it was concentrically shortening or eccentrically lengthening. In an isometric contraction, you get tension and no movement. Why is this important? If someone comes to you, and let's say they've had a catastrophic accident, or they've had a significant surgery, like I had. So I've had both my shoulders repaired. Both my supraspinatus have been repaired. Too many years of sports. And when you're done those surgeries, of course, when we think of the shoulder, I was actually in a sling for 12 weeks, not allowed to move my arm at all, right? So I lost a lot of strength and function in the shoulder. So because of the strength and function that I lost, my ability to concentrically contract and make things move, it wasn't there. It wasn't strong enough. So I might use, if someone had enough damage done or a significant surgery, I would isometrically train them first and then have them move with resistance, because that less injury, less chance of injury with an isometric contraction. Yes? No, that's concentric and eccentric. It would be this. Just leave your arm straight and make your bicep hard. That's isometric. So my therapy might be, so the patient just lays there on the table, you know, tighten your bicep, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, relax. That's isometric, okay? And I've seen patients who've had, you know, injury or whatever, doing that 3 times and they're like, oh, I'm exhausted, because the muscle has lost so much. But if I were to attempt to put a bar in their hand and ask them to do a curl, there's no way that could happen. They're not strong enough. So this is where isometric contractions come in. So we see here, did I go the right way? So isometric, we can see here, you know, and we also achieve sometimes isometric. If we lift something so heavy, nothing moves, right? We can feel our muscles contracting to the bar, and the bar will move, right? It becomes an isometric contraction. No, deadlift, you're still moving, right? You're still bringing the bar to here. You're not using these muscles. No, you don't. You shouldn't be using those in a deadlift.
Well, if you don't have a strap.
You're holding the bar. So I guess you could call that an isometric contraction because you're gripping the bar within the deadlift. But the deadlift is what muscle, folks? No, back. Hamstrings and glutes. I hate deadlifts. Hate them. For people who are not trained to do them. Okay? Deadlift is one of those exercises that is not a bad exercise if someone is trained to do them appropriately. I see far too many people in the gym who are doing deadlifts who haven't learned to do them properly, and the potential for injury is so high with a deadlift. You really have to be particular with your movement in a deadlift, or you will definitely hurt yourself. Okay? You hear me say this all the time. Same as what's it called, you know, that competition where, you know, they're doing pull-ups and leg lifts and CrossFit. I hate CrossFit. I have seen so many patients with injuries in CrossFit. So many. Okay. Now, so we've got the contractions, and we've got the movements in relationship to the axes. Muscles almost always function in groups rather than singly. You will always find it from a rehab perspective, I will try to give a patient an exercise that may isolate a single muscle. Okay? Because the reality is, in your day-to-day life, when you're in the gym working out or even doing things at home, you use groups of muscles to perform the task. Okay? I will give you a prime example. Had a gentleman in physio many, many years ago who had supraspinatus tendonitis. Okay, which is supraspinatus is one of the muscles of the shoulder, helps stabilize the shoulder, initiates abduction in the shoulder. This guy was huge. He was like an Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay, and we got his inflammation down, and it was time to train his supraspinatus. Now, a good supraspinatus exercise is flexion in what's called scaption. So I take the hand, and I put the thumb down towards the floor. I am not out to the side, nor am I directly in front. I'm halfway in between. And the exercise is from the leg to just beyond parallel to the ceiling. Okay? I handed this gentleman a 1 pound weight. And he laughed at me. I said, okay. I showed him how to do it. And I said, do it 10 times. He got to 5. And his eyes were like, what the heck is going on here? Why? Because I got down to one single muscle doing the work, which needed the work to be done, and it took everything else out. So that's the other thing you have to remember, is that we always function in groups. When a particular body movement is needed, groups of muscles are coordinated to the single function. So consciously, the brain says, I want to jump. I want to write the letter A. I want to swing a bat, whatever it is. Everything gets coordinated to work together to perform the task. You're too much out to the side. You need to be more forward that way. And drop that shoulder. Okay? So, when we think about muscles then, we said groups of muscles work. But we have muscles that are the prime muscle for that movement. So when we think about abduction, adduction, flexion, extension, rotations, whatever they may be, we have figured out that in so much as groups of muscles perform the task, there's always a single muscle that's the prime muscle for that movement. Okay? It does the majority of the work in that movement. Does everybody understand that? There's a muscle in every movement, one muscle that is the prime mover, which means it does the majority of the work in that movement, okay? This is known as an agonist, or the prime mover. The muscle which acts the most to initiate and maintain the movement desired, okay? The ones that work with it to perform the task are known as the synergist or the synergists. They assist the prime mover in the movement. When I tell you, when I'm introducing you to muscles, and I say this muscle's movements are, I will let you know what the prime movement is and what the secondary movements are when I teach them to you, okay? I've now found out I'm teaching you Clinical Anatomy 2 in the winter, which has a lot more movements because we're talking appendicular as compared to axial, right? Axial is more phasic, so it's more, you know, helping us stay strong and still and so forth. But so we have the agonist, which is the prime mover. We have the synergist, which assists the agonist in the movement. And then, so in this case, we have three muscles here that are involved in elbow flexion. We have biceps brachii, we have brachial radialis, and we have brachialis. All three of those muscles flex at the elbow. Can anybody guess which one is the prime mover? Okay, one says biceps brachii. Brachialis. Okay, brachialis is the prime mover. What's the prime movement of biceps brachii? You're not going to believe it. Supination. It is a powerful supinator. It is an elbow flexor, okay? Hammer curl is for brachioradialis. Brachioradialis is elbow flexion with the thumb in neutral, meaning the thumb is pointed toward the ceiling. So if I do arm work, I do this for biceps, long head biceps, right? I do these reverse for brachialis, and I do hammers for brachioradialis. Because in so much as they all do elbow flexion, they're all prime movers in different positions, with brachialis being the prime mover for elbow flexion, and long head biceps, the prime movement is supination. Okay? So, the motion, shoulder abduction, bringing the arm out like so. The agonist, the prime mover, is deltoid. It is the prime abductor at the shoulder. Its synergists are pectoralis major, supraspinatus, which is in the shoulder, part of the attachment on the scapula, and trapezius, which is that big muscle in the back. Now, some of you might say, how does pectoralis major do abduction? Because it does abduction above 90 degrees. Pectoralis major is not involved in abduction until you get here, and then it finishes it. Because you can see the attachment now suddenly pec major can pull. Okay, so here we got. Here's deltoid, the prime mover. There's pectoralis major, trapezius, and supraspinatus are all the synergists to the prime movement of shoulder abduction at the glenohumeral joint. The third muscle is a muscle that does the opposite to the agonist. So the agonist is the prime muscle for the movement. The antagonist is the opposite of the agonist. You've all started to learn PNS, yes? proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation. Have you done that yet? Okay, it's coming. Don't worry. Okay. So the antagonist is the muscle that resists the prime mover's actions and are responsible for the movement in the opposite direction. For every single muscle that's a prime mover, there is an opposite muscle that is its antagonist. So if there's a muscle that does shoulder flexion, there's a muscle that does shoulder extension. If there's a muscle that does elbow flexion, there's a muscle that does elbow extension. If there's a muscle that does abduction, there's a muscle that does adduction. Okay? And when I talk to you about how when there's movement, the brain inhibits one of the muscles so the prime mover can work. So when the prime mover is working, elbow flexion, the antagonist biceps is triceps. So when biceps is working, the brain inhibits the antagonist triceps. Sorry? Triceps don't work. Okay? In order for an agonist to contract, the nervous system must inhibit the antagonist to prevent it from contracting, thus allowing the agonist to fully shorten. Any questions? Am I that good? Is this review for some of you? Yes. Okay, so it's a great question. It's about to get complicated. Because an antagonist can be an agonist depending on the movement, can't it? Right. So it's when we relate to the target muscle. So if I want to make biceps my target muscle, I can say triceps is the antagonist. If I make the triceps my target muscle, biceps is the antagonist, right? So they can work both ways, right? Okay. So we can see here, here's our biceps, agonist, triceps, antagonist. Okay. Now, within a muscle, we have to look at the architecture a little bit because this plays a role in terms of how a muscle functions, what kind of range it has, and how strong it is. Within a muscle, we find muscle cell bundles. Remember I talked about, you know, the overcooked turkey at Thanksgiving and you pull all those strings out, right, of the turkey breast? Okay, those are fascicles. They're the bundles. So the thin, thin ones are the actual muscle fiber, but sometimes you pull a big, thick group out, right? So sometimes it's a little tiny thread, but sometimes you stick your fork in and you get a big, thick thing that comes out, okay? That's a group of those little threads. That's a group of muscle fibers, which are known as fascicles. Within a muscle, fascicles run parallel to each other. Now, in some cases, they run parallel to the long axis, and in others, the parallel fascicles can form patterns that are oblique to the long axis. Now, what does that mean? In rotation of my humerus, okay, right, the long axis is the length of the humerus. So that means that if I draw a bone, so we're just going to draw any kind of bone here, it doesn't really matter. Okay, we can say in the first statement, where'd my red one go? There it is. In the first statement, I say, in some muscles, these fascicles run parallel to the long axis. In other words, those fascicles would run this way. In some cases, fascicles run at angles to the long axis. Does everybody follow me? Yeah, so if you think of the example I use is take a piece of wood, right? We say wood has a grain, correct? Which means there's lines in it that sort of represent. Think of fascicles as the grain of the muscle, right? They run parallel to each other in a pattern to the axis of the movement. So, fascicular arrangement affects a muscle's power, how strong it can be, how fast it can contract, and what the range of the related joint or range of motion is, and its functional capabilities. So depending on the pattern of fascicles, a muscle can be strong. Another pattern can have a muscle contract and move very quickly. And another fascicular pattern could have a muscle have a very large range of motion. Make sense? Okay, so let's do parallel first. So In parallel muscles, the fascicles run parallel to the long axis and have flat tendon. Your sternocleidal mastoid here is considered to be a parallel muscle. Okay, so in rotation, because it's a rotator, our axis of rotation is here, and it's running parallel, generally, to the long axis of rotation. So that is known as a parallel. So all the fascicles are running parallel to each other along the long axis. The next is called a fusiform pattern. The fascicles are almost parallel. They terminate in flat tendons, and where the muscle comes into the tendon, it tapers. It becomes narrow. So you'll see me quite often, you know, I did it over here, right? You can see right here, right? Tapers at the ends to the tendons, right? Okay? That is a fusiform muscle. Biceps brachii is a fusiform muscle. They're nearly parallel, but we see tapering at the ends where they become tendinous. So this is it anatomically in the body, and this is what represents a fusiform muscle. Somewhat parallel, but not quite, and tapers at the ends. We have circular muscles, where the fascicles run in a circular nature. These are in a concentric circle. They form sphincters. We have many sphincters, one of which I know you're all thinking about right now, but there are others. Your mouth is a sphincter. Around your eye is a sphincter. For example, orbicularis oculi is a circular muscle around each eye that helps us to close our eyes. Okay? But the fascicular pattern is circular, so it's said to be a circular arrangement. The next type is a triangular arrangement, wide in one part, narrow in another. So the fascicles spread over a large area and converge at a central tendon, which represents pectoralis major. This is infraspinatus. This is another triangular muscle. But you can see you have your pectoralis major, right, is very wide here at the sternum and triangular-wise narrows into its attachment on the humerus. And you can see this is orbicularis oculi here. We can see how its circular placement of fascicles fits into the eye, which helps us open and close our eyelids. Okay. Pennate. Now, pennate offers the widest diversity of patterns. Pennate stands for feathers. So everybody knows what a feather looks like, right? Don't think of on the end of an arrow or whatever. Okay. So the fascicles run oblique to the long axis, and they resemble feathers. So if the fascicles lay on one side of the tendon obliquely, that is known as unipennate. If the fascicles run obliquely on both sides of the tendon, it is known as bipennate. And in some cases, there are multiple tendons with multiple oblique angles of fascicles. This is known as multipennate. An example of a unipennate is something called the palmar interossei, which are small muscles we find in the hand that run on either side of the metacarpals. Here is, what is this one? Anybody know what this muscle is? Which one? No. No, this is one of the quads. This is the deepest one. There's vastus lateralis, vastus medialis, valgus, vastus intermedius. Okay, so you have them on both sides. And then the multipennate, you can see here quite nicely in this drawing, we have a central tendon here at the bottom. Deltoid is a huge attachment. It comes from the spine of the scapula posteriorly all the way around onto the acromion to the clavicle. So it like grabs right around that shoulder cap, and we can see the various directions of fascicles that we see here in the deltoid. So it's known as multipennate. Unipennate, we said the fascicles are arranged on one side of the tendon. Another example is extensor digitorum longus. Save that for next semester. We can see it here in the leg. Bipennate, fascicles are arranged on both sides of the tendon, such as in rectus femoris that we see here. That's the most anterior of the quads. Multipennate is fascicles attached from many directions to several tendons, and this is, of course, the deltoid that we see here in this diagram. The longer and more nearly parallel the fascicles are in relation to each other, the more the muscle can shorten, so it increases its range. These are usually the more powerful muscles. The greater number of fascicles, of course, the greater the power, which makes sense, right? Because fascicles represent a parallel relationship between the contractile parts of a muscle. So the more you have, the stronger the muscle is going to be. The bipinnate and the multipinnate, which pack the most fibers, shorten very little but are extremely powerful. So it's all about these fascicles and their arrangement that relates to speed of contraction, strength of contraction, and the amount of shortening or range it can do. This is why, folks, okay, see the gym folks here. If I'm doing a bench press, which we shouldn't be doing anyways, right? You do a bench press. Is the bar to touch your chest or not? Where is your end range in a bench press? No. Not the place where you place the bar in relationship. Where's the end range? How far down do you come into a bench press? Till your triceps are parallel to the floor. That's it. What you see in the gym is, so you've got these powerful pectoralis major muscles. You come down to here. When you drop the bar down to your chest, to initiate from this low point to parallel to the floor, remember I said bench press should just come parallel to the floor. If I bring the bar down from this point to parallel to the floor, the anterior deltoid. How many people here know somebody who lifts weights relatively consistently and always bitch about the pain in the front of their shoulders? A lot, right? Why? Because bench, a pec could do 250 pounds, anterior deltoid can't. So if we come down too deep, we're asking a very small muscle to do work it's incapable of. So just parallel to the floor and up you come. Yeah, right? And most of the guys you talk to, and gals too, who do a lot of bench pressing, they're the ones who bitch the most about the sore shoulder, anterior shoulders, right? Okay? But people will say, well, I've heard that, you know, to gain strength, it has to be full range. They are absolutely correct. Here is full range for pectoralis major. Not here. Anterior deltoids. It has to get you to here before back pecs will take over. Yeah, I go crazy in the gym. I bite my tongue a lot. Because I watch people and I go, oh, God. Oh, here's my card. So, again, remember, fascicular arrangement plays a very strong role in strength, range, and speed. Okay? Now, naming muscles. So we're going to have all these different names that we're going to do as we're going through. Most muscles are named according to either their shape, the bones in which they attach to, the function they perform, or the number of bellies or heads that they have. So, adductor magnus, what does that tell you? It adducts and it is big. It's the biggest one, right? Okay. Quadratus lumborum, what's that tell you? Lumbar is your back, and what does quadratus? See, what do you think that means? Not four heads. It is square, correct. It has four surfaces, right? I'm trying to get you to understand that quite often in tests, when you're not sure, just read the names, right? It'll help you. I do ask questions sometimes in tests with something I know you don't know. But you know what the others are. So if the others all fit, then this one's not like the others, and that's usually the right answer, right? Biceps brachii. Brachii stands for brachium is the upper arm, and biceps means two heads, right? And last one is rotatores, rotation. You find them in the spine. They have us rotate. Okay? So again, quite often in anatomy, because we try to standardize as much as we can, The names will tell you so much. Now, like I said many times, there are, on quite a number of occasions, I'm not sure what the those who are doing the dissection, what they were smoking, but they sometimes say certain things, and I'm like, yeah, I don't get that. I don't see that shape anywhere, but somehow they saw it. Okay? All right. So that's, for now, the last introduction to anatomy, but we have a couple things to go through. Now, I don't know whether or not you have taken this yet in your consolidation labs or not. But if not, that's okay, because this is normally I do it first, but maybe you did it first in lab. Have you talked about muscle testing? Okay, we're talking about muscle testing. Yes. The one that I replaced?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's for later on. We'll get to that later on, but not right now. Part two. I put this in part two. That's the right one. Yeah, it's the only one I changed. Okay. Did I say something? No, I didn't say break. We had to go for a pee. That's okay.
So when you're like, you said where the shoulder.
Yeah.
When you go past the.
Yeah. No, you bench to the strength your pectoralis major can do, but when you drop it down, you're now forcing a smaller muscle to perform a particular weight that muscle's too small to deal with, and then you get damage. It's the same as if you squat too deep, right? Yes, and now what you've done is you've removed the glutes, and you can't get up because now you've taken them out and you're getting into other muscles that can't at all deal with that weight that's on the bar. Then you're in trouble. That's why if you're by yourself, use a Smith bench. Do not do squats alone free. It's not a good idea. About 8 years ago, there was a woman who was working out by herself. She was doing bench, and I can't remember what it was, but she lost control, and she dropped the bar, and she crushed her trachea, and she died. Your windpipe. The bar came down onto her neck and crushed her neck. She didn't have a partner. Okay, muscle testing. Now, this is the ability to isolate a specific muscle through standardized positions and movements to test the muscle's ability to contract, right? So we use this to confirm. So you guys have talked about confirmation of your palpations, right? You have talked about that in lab? Okay, so if I'm going to have a muscle that I need to palpate, I need to understand its attachments and its actions, and then I resist its action. If I'm palpating the appropriate structure, it should pop out to meet my hand, and I know I'm on the right structure. Have I talked about that in consolidation? Not too much yet? You'll get there. So you'll find that muscle testing is an integral part of the physical examination. Although we will be not using it for that purpose this semester, it will be addressed in the assessments course. So that's coming up in a couple of semesters. But we are doing a little bit of introduction to muscle testing in this semester. Can also use it to isolate a specific muscle for length as well as strength. What does that mean? Who wants to come up? No taking off shirts or anything. Come on up. Somebody come up. Okay. You can take the jacket off just so I can get out. So let's say, for example, biceps. Okay, now here's why it's important to know actions. Okay, so you have to understand the action. I already told you that there's three muscles in this elbow that do elbow flexion, right? Biceps, brachialis, and brachioradialis. Okay, so if he is weak in flexion of the elbow, I then have to wonder which one's the problem. So I have to, in some way, isolate each one of those three and test their strength to possibly see which one is the problem. Follow me so far? Yeah, okay. So let's say I want to do brachialis. I will ask him to bend his elbow and turn his hand towards the floor. I, with my other hand, stabilize my patient, okay? Right? I don't leave him out there and just do that because I want a controlled resistance. So I stabilize proximal to where I'm testing. Ask you to make a fist, and what's going to happen, I'm going to push down towards the floor, and you're going to resist me, okay? So you go ahead, and 5, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and relax. Okay? And then I grade that. How much strength is he giving me? Or in other words, how much resistance does he have? Right? Does he have no resistance at all? So he's had a stroke, and when I push, there's nothing. Right? That's a possibility. Or he really pushes back well, then that's a grade 5. We'll get to the grades in a minute, but his muscle's functioning well. So I just tested muscle elbow flexion there. Now I'm going to test biceps. Now biceps, I said, does two things. It does elbow flexion and it does supination. So now I have to have him resist elbow flexion and supination. So what I'm going to do is put his hands like this. I'm going to try to push your thumb down and push your arm down and relax. So I did both movements, okay? I try to put him into pronation, right? And he's supinating to avoid that. And then I'm trying to extend his elbow, and he's elbow flexing to prevent that. Is everybody following me so far? So now I've isolated long head biceps. The last one I want to do is brachioradialis. So now I'm going to put his hand in neutral, meaning his thumb is pointed to the ceiling. Again, I'm still stabilizing. I'm going to, again, push to the floor, and you're going to resist me, and you're going to relax. Thanks. Okay, so now I've isolated brachioradialis. So what I've done is I've isolated three muscles in movements to test their strength. If I was palpating those structures, so my OP said today, please palpate brachioradialis, I would go through the routine of palpating brachioradialis. I would then put his thumb in a neutral position and have him resist elbow flexion. And if I'm palpating the right muscle, it'll come up to meet me by getting firm. Everybody follow me? Okay. All right. So we say that muscle testing can be used to test a specific muscle for length as well as strength. So I can also lengthen muscles by isolating them to see if they happen to be tight and short. Does that make sense to everybody? So instead of resisting the movement, I would put it out and try to lengthen the muscle to see if it's tight. Does that make sense to everybody? In other words, stretch it. Right? Okay. So, muscles which are, this is really something that's important. Muscles which are too long, too short, too strong, or too weak results in imbalances at that joint. Too long, too short, too strong, too weak. Here's the rule. Short muscles are strong and long muscles are weak. Short muscles are strong and long muscles are weak. So, you go to a massage. They treat you because your back's sore, right? So you've done all this work on your back. Okay? Got a nice feeling good. You get off the table, you think, wow, this is great. The problem is, you sit like this all day. Okay? Long and weak, short and strong. So if all I do is rub your back and make you feel good and walk out the door, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to feel good for a couple days, and I didn't address the issue, did I? I need to lengthen the short, and I need to strengthen the long. That way I get the balance back and the patient feels better. Does that make sense to everybody? That is really a big to take away. Okay, I will in a sec, because here's the problem. 99% of the time I talk to patients, did you go and see a therapist, a massage therapist? Yes, I did. What do they give you? Stretches. Because in their heads, for whatever reason, we've gotten in this habit in massage that everything's short and needs to be stretched. A lot of pain patterns are the result of weakness, not of tight muscles. A lot more than you consider. Can I borrow you for a second? Come on up. I'm going to try to sort of show you here from a, just come this way, just sort of face the wall. Okay, so we have something called an anterior head carriage, okay, which is really common in our culture. So I want you to kind of just slump your back a bit so you kind of drop down a little bit, okay? And then bring, see, notice how his head's forward in that position? Do you see how his head's forward, right? He's got his, don't fight me here for a sec, just relax. So see, how many people you know kind of stand in that kind of posture, yes? Right? The shoulders are slumped,
the head's forward and the head has to come up because the eyes always want to keep the horizon, right? Okay, so this is called anterior head carriage, okay? So stay there for a minute. Look up, though. Look up with your head forward. That's it. Good. So this is long and weak. This is short and strong. So he comes to you and he says, my neck hurts and my back's sore. So what do we do? Great, we're good. Thanks very much. See you later. How do you feel? I feel like $1 million. Haven't solved the problem. Okay? This needs to be long. I need to stretch this out, right? Get this anterior part longer. Get this, stronger to pull everything back. Oh, God, yes. Oh, absolutely. But you get the idea. Really take this home because this is really important. Absolutely. Absolutely. This only represents about 40% of what we can do. It drives me absolutely bonkers that so many therapists think their only job is to throw someone on the table, bring out the lotion, and rub them. Yes, it works. I like it too. There's a lot of benefit to this. But it doesn't fix the problem. How many people here plan to be really successful therapists and make some money? Okay. So how do you think you're going to get busy? Advertising? No. Right. So he comes to me and he feels good for a couple days. Yeah, Dormer's not bad. He comes to me in over a six-week period. I take away his problem. How many people do you think he's going to tell? Right? There is so much to consider when you treat somebody other than just rubbing them and giving them some stretches. Because this anterior head carriage could be the result of poor posture. So the other thing I may do with him is spend a considerable amount of time getting him to understand normal posture, right? Training him normal posture to try to prevent all this problem. Now, if he's had this anterior head carriage, to your point, for so long, the longer they have it, the longer it's going to take it away, okay? So you have to, I remember one time I saw a gentleman, he'd been to everybody. He came to his back pain, and I did an assessment, and I said, yeah, Todd, I can fix this. Two things. One, it's going to hurt. You're going to be sore. And secondly, this is going to take at least 6 months because you've had this for like 2 years. And he said, okay. He told everybody because I made him better. And that's the other thing to take away. Some of what we do is not comfortable, right? There's still this thing out there about massage that we don't hurt people, okay? I hurt people. I don't harm people, okay? I'm not doing damage to them. But I'm doing things. How many people here have been to physio, right? And then the next day you're like, oh my God, what the hell did they do to me, right? And then the day after that, hey, wow, right? Because it's a reaction. Again, if he's been in a bad posture for so long, I'm going to put him here. His body's going to say, I don't like this very much. Because remember I talked about a few weeks ago, this posture here, his brain now is rewired that thinks that this is normal. So now I'm not only fighting his body, I'm also fighting his brain to get him to understand that this is what I want. Thanks. Okay? So that's what's so important about understanding weak, long, short, strong. All of it's in balance. And what we want to do is balance all of that out. We get better outcomes. I'll let you guys go in a minute. The other thing to remember, every muscle is a prime mover in some specific direction or action. Okay? Short muscles, I would lengthen. Correct. Try to remember that as time goes on. Long muscles need to be strengthened and short muscles need to be lengthened. No two muscles in the body have exactly the same function. This is what's important to understand in muscle testing. Every movement has a prime mover. Every muscle has one prime movement and a number of smaller movements that would be synergistic to the other prime mover. So when we're muscle testing, what we wish to do is take that muscle and force it to work in its prime responsibility. Does everybody follow that? When I want to isolate a muscle, I challenge it in its primary movement. Okay? Fundamental components of manual muscle testing are test performance and evaluation of muscle strength and length. You're going to learn how to isolate specific muscle and have it contract in order to confirm your palpation. That's the point of the muscle testing. For now, you're not muscle testing, but what you're doing is you're understanding where a muscle goes so that you ask the patient to perform a particular movement to confirm your palpation. Okay? That's what we're after. But this top statement is kind of important, again, to think about. From a muscle testing perspective, it's like McDonald's French fries, right? That's the big thing. Everybody's like, McDonald's French fries? What? Where'd that come from? McDonald's theory is no matter where you go in the world to McDonald's, those French fries will be exactly the same in most cases, right? That's what they want, right? They want everybody to have the same French fries. The same thing should happen in the standardization of muscle testing. So whether a patient goes to you or you or you or you or you, you're all doing it the same to consistently determine what the muscle, what muscle's the problem, whether it's strength or length or so forth, so that you're getting consistent care across the spectrum of therapists. Everybody follow me? All right? That's why you really want to pay attention to how to do it properly and how to isolate the muscles so that no matter who the patient goes to, you're being tested appropriately. So how do we do this? Place the patient in a position that offers the best fixation of the body as a whole. So you saw that when I was testing the arm, I stabilized the arm. Because if I don't, then synergistic muscles will come into play. So the posture that you put the patient in is all about how to isolate that muscle and not have the body call in synergists. Okay? So that's first. Second, stabilize the part proximal to the tested part, or as in the case of the hand, adjacent to the tested part. You need stabilization. Stabilization, again, prevents synergistic contraction, which gives you false results. Okay? Third, place the part to be tested in precise anti-gravity test position whenever appropriate to help elicit the desired muscle action and aid in grading. Use test movements in the horizontal plane when testing muscles that are too weak. So in some cases, if someone, say, had a stroke, They may not be strong enough to even lift the arm up against gravity. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to get them on the table, have them perform the same motion, taking gravity out, and use me in some cases, or just the friction of the table, as the resistance. I know that doesn't make a whole lot of sense right now, because you've never come across anybody who has had a stroke and is completely, they have what's called flaccid paralysis. They just have this arm that just kind of hangs there and it can't do anything. Right? You won't understand until you actually see that the first time. But imagine that you've got a limb that can't do anything. We're not going to ask them to do this, are you? Because there's no way it's going to happen. But maybe they can do that on the table, you know, sliding around. They might have enough for that. Apply pressure directly opposite the line of pull. You saw that when I had him set up, I was applying pressure in the direction I wanted the limb to go into. Again, ensure that I isolate the muscle. The pressure helps to elicit the desired muscle action. We apply the pressure gradually, but not too slowly, allowing the patient to get set and hold. We apply uniform pressure. We avoid localized pressure that can cause discomfort. So the rule we have here at the college is you start to apply pressure and you count to five. And as you count to five, you apply a little bit more pressure. So you go one, two, three, four, five, and then you count down with that pressure, five, four, three, two, one. And then you gently release the resistance that you've placed. What we're after with the five up and the five down is because if there's a neurological issue within that count, they might start ratcheting because the nervous system isn't functioning properly. Okay? Use a long lever whenever possible unless contraindicated. The length of the lever is determined by the location of the pressure along the lever arm. Come on back up for a second again. All right, so come on, just face the class again. We're going to do avduction. Okay. Everybody here know levers? Anybody here do physics? Haven't understand levers at all? Okay. Okay. The longer the lever is, the less work I have to do, correct? Everybody understand that? The longer the lever is, the less work I have to do. Now, if I've got Ronnie Coleman on the table and I want to measure strength in the legs, right? If I'm down here, I'm going to have to work really hard to maintain it. If I get out to the length of the lever, I work less to perform the same task. See the difference? Same thing for the patient. Here, he is. You look, see how strong he is? Right? Okay, if I come all the way out here, try. Yeah, see? Because the lever's longer, and under the rules of levers, I've made it harder. I've made the work harder because of the length of the lever. Okay? It's the same thing with weight training. Right? You want those levers to be long because you put more emphasis on the muscle of which you're doing it. Thanks. Okay. All right? So, use the lever. You know, in some cases, some of us are a bit smaller in stature. We might have somebody very large on the table. Using that lever is really advantageous for us to perform the resistance so the muscle contraction. So we can see here, this is the setup for long head biceps. And this is the other book we will be using. It's called Your Muscle Manual. It's a big old-fashioned looking book. It's large, kind of bluey-gray kind of cover on it. That's what this picture comes out of. And what I want you to take, I want you to use that book. Because students say, we never use that book. Well, you should, because it shows you how to test every freaking muscle in the body. Okay? It shows you the setup, supine or sitting. It shows you where to fixate or tells you. It shows you how to do the test. And where to place the pressure for all the muscles. So if you come across a muscle in the clinic that you want to test and you can't remember, you should have your book with you. Look it up. And the book will explain how to muscle test it. This will be for abdomen. So this is doing rectus abdominis, for example. You can see stabilization is here. And the pressure is here, right? Still stabilizing, right? Consistent muscle testing comes from complete knowledge of the origin, insertion, proximal and distal attachments and action of the muscle. This is why it's so important to do the work and know your muscles. Because if you don't know where they attach and what they do, how are you going to figure out how to test them? We are not going to show you how to muscle test every single muscle in the human body. We would be here for a month. Okay? But if you know the action and you know where they attach, you generally can figure it out, and then the fine nuances will be in the textbook. You will not always be shown the specifics to test the muscle. You know the attachments and the created movements. Knowing this, you can always isolate a specific muscle to test. During our range of motion assessment, we test for strength in certain ranges. You'll learn about that. We are also able to try to isolate individual muscles to test their strength. When we test a muscle's strength, we grade it. Okay? And this is something I do want you to know, likely be on the test next week. If there's absolutely no contraction whatsoever, it's rated as a zero. If it's full strength, no problem, it's a five. Four is movement with minimal resistance. Three, you can move against gravity, but not resistance. Two, I have to assist the patient a little bit to have them move. And one is there's contraction, but there's no movement at all. You can't even move them. There's a little flittering muscle contraction there, but nothing's happening. Okay? So this is how we standardize what we're seeing and the outcome of the movement. Take a break. We'll see you guys top there. There we go. Now it's working. Nope, I did not. I was having a conversation with your peers. There you go. Come on, really? Will you stop doing this? I don't want to extend. I want that to be my default. Okay, one small last set of slides to get through before we start on the head. So, in your consolidation labs, have you talked about trigger points? Very briefly. Okay. Has anybody heard the term trigger point before? What do you think it is? Sorry? What is it, though? A point. Okay. Anything else you know about it? So, what is a trigger point? How do you know you're on a trigger point? So you're going to see a lot of pictures like this coming up over the next couple of semesters when I introduce you to muscles. X's mark the common place you find a trigger point, wherever that might be on whatever muscle. And then the red patterns represent referral. Now, trigger points refer. So in other words, when you touch them, the pain is not usually found where the trigger point is. It's found some distance away from the trigger point. And these kind of diagrams show you the trigger point pattern. Where it is thick red is where the pain is most intense. And where you see the speckles is where you'll find less intense pain, but following through the intense parts. And you can see the pattern in particular for upper trapezius looks like a backwards question mark, for example, right? Generally speaking, okay? So this picture indicates where the primary trigger point would be with an X pattern on it. The shaded area would be the referral pattern. Each trigger point has a common referral pattern. And how do we treat it? Well, we use Muscolino to treat. We'll get there. So what is a trigger point? A trigger point is a hyper-irritable area in skeletal muscle or its associated fascia that is associated with a hypersensitive and palpable nodule. In other words, it's like a nut inside the muscle that's firm and hard, and it's extremely palpable. We can kind of roll over it and feel it. It's hypersensitive in that the patient will express some discomfort when we touch said nodule. We also know it as a knot. Now, within the knot, the muscle can also be a taut band. The area is painful when we compress on it and can give rise to a number of symptoms. Now, we talked about referred pain. We saw it in the picture. We can say referred pain, also referred tenderness. We also can get motor dysfunction, which is like a twitch, and autonomic phenomena, which can include vasoconstriction, pilomotor, in other words, goosebumps response, and hypersecretion. We'll get sweating in the area as well. So these things can happen when we're palpating that nodule or that trigger point. They exist in almost every soft tissue of the body, including muscle, muscular fascia, the periosteum, ligaments, and skin. And I've noted that as well. I also think feel that I have found them in the joint capsules as well when I'm treating. I am a trigger point therapist or was a trigger point therapist. I spent a lot of time on trigger points. Now, you are going to hear therapists. What's that? Joint capsules. And you'll have therapists who say, well, I've never felt the trigger point. Of which my argument is, no, you haven't because you're not pushing hard enough. Okay? I've had therapists say they've never felt a trigger point, never had a trigger point, in which case they're not pushing hard enough. This is something that I challenge you on. You can always tell new therapists, and fair enough because of your experiences, you don't tend to be too assertive when your patients, right? Your touch is relatively light because you're unsure of, you know, are you gonna hurt the patient or whatever. Trigger point hurt. Okay? They're supposed to hurt. That's the point. You can't fix them without hurting them. Okay? Now I also go for something called dry needle treatment. I don't know if anybody here have been dry needled. Okay, so what they do is they take an acupuncture needle, and rather than putting it in an acupuncture site, they find the trigger point, and they put the needle in the trigger point, and they go, the needle, till the muscle spasms, then they pull the needle out. Yes, it hurts a lot, but it works. But it works. Okay, so I challenge you then, you know, when you're thinking about working with your clients, you want to get into tissue. We're going to learn various levels of tissue as we go through here. Some muscles are relatively superficial, so they're just under the skin. We can palpate them. Some muscles are way down there, which means you have to go way down there to get them. And unfortunately, sometimes they're uncomfortable. It's okay to be uncomfortable, right? It is supposed to be a little bit sore. There are trigger points all over the place. I can tell you there's all kinds of common ones. Right now, I could probably almost the entire room here, I could palpate all your infraspinatuses, and you'd all have a trigger point in them. Pretty much 99% of the time when I palpated and treated patients, they get trigger points in their infraspinatus. Always. Refers to the front of the shoulder. Another one is sternocleidal mastoid. Quite often, a lot of people have them in there as well. We'll learn it. It's an overworked, overused muscle that usually finds itself with a trigger point. So sometimes masseter here and medial and lateral pterygoid, if you're a gum chewer and you chew a lot of gum, these things get overworked, they get trigger points in them. right? Or if you're a clencher or a grinder, they get trigger points in them. Bad posture, you're going to get trigger points in your back, right? And on and on and on, those sorts of things. So it's something you're going to come across. I challenge you, though, you've got to get in at them to treat them, okay? I'm not saying it has to be a 10 out of 10 pain or anything, but you do have to get in to get at them. So what we're seeing here is, you know, we talked about those fascicles and the muscle fibers that represented the cells. So we have the drawing here that kind of represents the cells. Now, we're going to learn there's an interaction between two microfibers called actin and myosin that results in a muscle contraction. When we have a trigger point, the actin and myosin stay connected, which forms these nodules in the tissue that we feel as, you know, traditionally knots. Someone has a knot inside, right? Now, you can have a knot that's not a trigger point, but you can have a knot that is a trigger point. And it's the certain criteria that the knot must meet in order to say it does have a trigger point. It is a trigger point, okay? So the continuously contracted knot in the muscle fiber stops blood flow at the trigger point, starving the tissue of oxygen and nutrients, which further promotes the tightening and the nodular configuration of the muscle. In other words, it cuts its own supply off and it perpetuates this chronic, constant nodule trigger point that the patient comes in because they're having pain or discomfort, right? So quite often, patients will come to me. Anybody here get chronic headaches? Okay. Where? Forehead? Okay. I know where your trigger point is. Where's yours? Here's the front as well, probably the same thing. It's because the way you're sitting, because you sit a lot. Yeah, where's yours? Sorry? On the crown? Okay, I know where that trigger point is too, right? That's why it's important to know the patterns, because the patterns will help tell you where some of it may be. I have treated more patients with headaches who've been everywhere imaginable, and I go, where's your headache? Well, it does this, and it goes there. Oh, I know what that is. And then I go with my thumb, and oh, there it is. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. And then the headache goes away. Sorry? You got to work with it over and over. And again, it's the same as what I talked about earlier. If it's chronic bad posture that's the result in the muscle being overworked and having the trigger point, well, then there's some training involved in sitting properly or standing properly or strengthening or lengthening or whatever it may be. All together. That's why your challenge is, when we get to the muscles, you need to know your patterns. It tells you so much. Trigger points can be classified as active, which means even when you're sitting there doing nothing, you have pain, right? You have this certain pain pattern, okay? A latent trigger point is a trigger point that you don't know you have it till I stick my bony thumb in there, and you go, oh my God, that's referring up the top of my head, right? Because you didn't know you had it. So that's latent, whereas active is just kind of there. Primary arises in response to trauma or acute or chronic overload. So the muscle's getting tired, right? Because you sit poorly or you're working in Honda and you're doing the same thing for 8 or 9 or 10 hour shifts, right? That causes problems. Satellite trigger point is activated by a key trigger point being in the area of referral or its antagonist or synergist. So sometimes you may have a primary trigger point in the muscle, and along its referral pattern, you'll find satellite trigger points, right? You can work on both, but the key one, of course, is eventually get to the primary, and that helps resolve a lot. Central is located near the center of the muscle fibers, and, of course, attachment trigger points are found in the tendon or the aponeurosis of said muscle. So a couple things we have to talk about here is, what is a muscle? So sarcomeres run into and along a muscle fiber. So if I drew a muscle fiber, it would look something like this. You would get this long line of muscle. And then within the muscle, you would see these particular lines. Each one of these squares is a sarcomere. Okay? So 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, there's 4 sarcomeres in there. So they run end to end along the muscle fibers. And remembering, of course, fibers run parallel to each other. So, of course, there would be another muscle fiber here. Now, I have given them a space, but there really shouldn't be. And you would have exactly the same thing happening there. They run parallel to each other, right? Okay. So, 2 types of protein strands, actin and myosin, that interact. They attach and separate to pull the 2 ends of the sarcomere closer together. So I've used the term already, that when a muscle contracts, it shortens, right? The 2 ends come together. The reality is, and that's not incorrect, it's absolutely correct, The sarcomere is the functional unit of a muscle. It is each of the sarcomeres, shortening, with the interaction of actinomycin, that results in the entire muscle fiber shortening. Does everybody understand that? Right? The functional unit is the sarcomere, and with the interaction of the actinomycin, the sarcomere shorten, and because they're stacked end to end, the whole darn thing shortens. And because they all run parallel to each other, they're all shortening. Okay? Surrounding the sarcomere is a network of tubules called the sarcoplasmic reticulum that contains lots of calcium. You don't need to know what the sarcoplasmic reticulum is. Just understand that there's calcium. There's a storage area in the architecture of muscle that stores calcium. Okay? A motor nerve is said to innervate the muscle, which means it influences the muscle through neural stimulation. So we have a motor neuron that arises in the spinal cord, and it penetrates the muscle, and then it comes down and branches to innervate each fiber in the muscle, right? So up here is the brain, eventually way up there. It sends, if it wants a muscle contraction to occur, it sends what's called an action potential, and that nerve stimulus goes all the way down to the muscle fiber, and it is that stimulus in the motor neuron that causes the muscle to shorten. So far, so good? Okay? Any questions? Yes. The myosin and actin are fibers that exist in a particular configuration, and it is the interaction of the actin and myosin that results in the shortening of each sarcomere. Okay? So we got the nerves. So where the nerve and the muscle meet is called the motor end plate. Okay? That's where we have a conversation between the nervous system and the muscle. The nerve stimulates the muscle fiber to contract at the end plate. This stimulation causes that sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is the storage container for all the calcium, to release its calcium. And the calcium causes the actin and myosin to interact, thus using ATP, resulting in contraction. So if you're actin and I'm myosin, okay, we love each other a lot. We want to touch each other like crazy. We have this attraction that's really strong, okay? But when a muscle is relaxed, there's something that's blocking between the two of us, and we can't connect, therefore we don't get contraction. In the presence of calcium that is released by the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the thing that blocks you and I disappears, and we connect, and then contraction starts. So it's calcium that bathes the area that results in the actin and myosin connecting, and therefore we get contraction. So far, so good? Okay? All right. After contraction, the calcium returns back to the endoplasmic, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, to await another stimulus to result in another contraction. ATP is required for the interaction between actin and myosin and is required to put the calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So we have a container that contains calcium. The message comes down from the brain to say contract. It stimulates this container and sends out all this calcium. Okay? Actin and myosin get together. Now, how muscle contraction works is the myosin pulls along the actin. It actually grabs it, pulls itself along, almost like a rope. Okay? And we get contraction. When contraction's over, we need to get rid of that calcium so that we don't touch each other anymore, so the muscle can go back into a relaxed state. So ATP is used to pump the calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum to wait for the next time it gets stimulated. So far, so good? Okay, so if deprived of ATP molecules, of course, there is a crisis due to insufficient energy, and the sarcomere contraction continues, resulting in the formation of a trigger point. So we had this nodule, which means that the actin and the myosin are stuck together. If we have a lack of ATP, I can't pump the calcium out, so it stays contracted. This little nodule stays contracted. Okay? So that's what a trigger point is. This is one theory of it. If there's no ATP, then there's no separation of actin and myosin. The underlying cause of the lack of ATP molecules is ischemia. Remember, if we're stuck in contraction, I'm actually squeezing off my own blood supply. Therefore, I can't get more ATP because I need oxygen to create ATP. and I need ATP to get rid of the calcium. Well, I don't have any ATP, so the calcium doesn't go away. We're stuck together, and we squeeze harder, and we cut off even more blood supply. Get the idea?
What does ATP mean?
Adenosine triphosphate. It is the gasoline that fires all the engines in the body. It's the fuel source for everything. This then initiates a vicious cycle called contraction ischemia cycle. The muscle contraction causes ischemia, thereby creating a deficiency of ATP. Without ATP, the muscle tissue cannot relax and therefore stays contracted. Its contraction then continues to cut off the arterial blood supply, furthering the ischemia and so on. It is for this reason that once trigger points form, they tend to persist unless a therapeutic intervention occurs. So what do? We do something called a digital ischemic compression. So I find a trigger point, and I shove my thumb in it, and I make it even more ischemic on purpose. I even cut off more blood supply. That's why the patient goes, ouch, okay, and they stay with it. And what will happen is the muscle will go, I don't have anything anymore. And you'll literally feel, when you get good at it, the muscle will go from a firm, hard nodule, and it will melt underneath your finger. Just gone. And maybe as a patient you felt that, where the therapist is in there, and you're like, oh my God, am I going to survive this? And all of a sudden it just goes, it's gone. I move my thumb out, and guess what happens? All this blood comes flushing in. Cleans all the crap out and brings all the oxygen in, and the trigger point doesn't come back. Sorry? They can, absolutely. So the other thing is, and this again is a bit of my theory, but I treat trigger points like an onion. Okay? You've got layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. So if a trigger point's bad, maybe the onion is this big, right? And being like the onion, the real problem isn't out here on the edge. It's way down here in the middle. So maybe today we work together, I only get two or three layers in because it's not releasing for me, right? So this is why you need to see somebody a few more times, because I go in two layers and go in two more layers and go in two more layers until I eventually get to the one that's really causing the problem, and then the whole thing does go, ugh, okay. No, it just stops the interaction of actinomycin, which relaxes it, which cuts off the ischemia, and all this blood comes in and you start solving the problem. Oh, yeah. Especially if they come from a trauma like bad posture, where you're constantly promoting it through bad habits, certain movements, all those sorts of things. There's something called the energy crisis hypothesis. Venous vessels are also affected by the contracted muscle, which results in the inability to remove waste products. Because when a muscle contracts, there's byproducts and we need to get rid of them. This results in creating a more acidic environment, which results in the pain in the region, and more causes of the pain, spasm, pain cycle, which increases the ischemia. What's it feel like when you get down into the last couple of contractions if you're really doing it right? Does it hurt? Like really bad, right? Ischemia and more acidic. Right? That's why you get the failure, because the muscle can't contract anymore. You've cut off the blood supply. And you've got a buildup of lactic acid, therefore an acidic environment, and you couldn't have another contraction even if you wanted to. Right? So you give it a rest, a minute, so you can go back to do the contractions again, right? Same idea. Therefore, a muscle that contracts for an elongated period of time will result in a trigger point due to the energy crisis. Sitting badly, those erectors in your back are contracting all day, every day, every time. They're going to get worn out and get trigger points. That's where blood supply to a muscle has been cut off and there's no oxygen getting to the muscle. Trigger points most often form at the motor point of the muscle, usually located at the center of the muscle where the motor neurons synapse with the muscle fibers. This is known as the dysfunctional end plate hypothesis. So this talks about that when a motor neuron continually carries the message for a muscle to contract, it becomes dysfunctional and secretes excess amounts of muscle stimulation, causing the muscle fibers motor end plate to produce excessive numbers of action potentials, which results in a reduction of ATP, which results in excessive contraction, which results in lack of ATP to clear calcium out, which results in ischemia, which results in pain, which results in a trigger point. Yes.
What would happen if you have too much, or sorry, a deficiency in calcium?
that's where you get the spasms and those sorts of things, or you get weakness. So there's an association between potassium, calcium, and sodium in muscle contraction. That's why electrolytes need to be kept at a certain level. Otherwise, we can't do it properly. So I'm not going to go through all these, other than to say, what create trigger points? Excessive muscle contraction creates a trigger point. Irritation, injury, and trauma creates a trigger point. Perceived pain creates trigger points. Muscle splinting. When we have damage, say we've hurt our back, right? We've got a disc problem. Well, the muscles around the back will spasm to help splint and provide support to the bad back that's hurting. Well, you've got muscle contraction, extended periods of time, you're going to get a trigger point. Prolonged shortening, right? Prolonged stretching, too long for long periods of time, causes trigger points too. Given the client's treatment plan indicates the possibility that trigger points may be present, we identify the trigger points by indicating at least two of the following: local tenderness within a taut band of muscle, a local twitch response, so when you push on the trigger point, the muscle twitches, and or a client's reported referred pain tenderness or autonomic phenomena. So you push on it, they feel the referral pattern. Okay? Client is informed that the treatment of myofascial trigger points may be painful. That's key. It does hurt. Put simply, consent. You have to get consent to ensure the patient understands this is going to hurt, but we're going to fix it. Now, you're going to learn there's some control things that you do when you do a trigger point thing. I'm just introducing you to the theory of trigger points today. So you can see there's all kinds of patterns. And you, ladies and gentlemen, need to get to know all of them, the ones that I give you. You need to know them because they're vitally important. Again, where's your headache? Well, it's here. Okay, yeah, that's probably either SCM or upper trapezius. It helps you in your treatments, right? It makes you a better therapist. Yes. Is where the pain is felt more intensely. It still refers, it's just not as intense. Okay? Do you want to find out? The treatment technique is applied until the client tells you the level of referred pain either decreases or is eliminated, and then you stop. If you don't get diminished pain or decrease in pain, you stop as well. Follow the treatment of the trigger point. The treated muscle is stretched, and some authors suggest heat. But whenever you trigger point that muscle, you must stretch it out. And if you are going to treat a trigger point, you must finish treating the trigger point. Because if you don't, you can make it worse. Okay, you must resolve it. Okay? Not used or is modified if a contradiction to this technique exists. So, again, if, and of course, if the client says, no, I'm not going to get into this performing or after, I'm just saying here what you need, you know, knowing the referral patterns is important. Identify key trigger points and perpetuating factors, and then the techniques you're going to learn in lab in the coming weeks. Okay? That's it for trigger points. You're going to learn a whole lot today?
Yeah.
You don't know me very well, do you? Just finished, right? Nope. What did I tell you guys the very first week here?
Are we behind now?
We're behind. We're catching up. We'll catch up. Don't you worry.
We're behind every week.
Well, that was the question. Oh, my God, are we going to catch up? Yes, we will catch up. I promise. Okay, please pull out your heads. I have extras. Does anybody want one? Where's yours? I feel like Halloween here. What's that? Yes, that's what I want. That's what I told you to do. Yeah. Okay. There you go. That's all I got. I need the rest. So we'll get there. We're going to know them all. Okay. You all have your skulls with you. So this is what it looks like when it's all blown up. Everybody's too young here to know about blowing up. Second City TV. Any Second City TV fans here? That blew it up real good. Oh, no, I know. You're all too young. If you ever get a chance, watch Second City TV. It's hilarious. So, please understand, inside mom, okay, when we talk about bone development in the second half, each of these plates, all sort of separated here, all developed on their own to create the overall skull. Okay? They all started with a cartilage model and then grew into what you see before you as being the skull. It is also known as the calvaria, the brain case, and or the cranial vault. There are three functions to this skull. It houses the special organs of the senses. So you see through the skull, you smell through the skull, you hear through the skull, and you taste through the skull. Right? They're all there. It encloses the brain. So when you take the top off that skull, that big space that you see in there is where your brain would be. It's where it's housed. It also surrounds the openings for the digestive and respiratory tracts, of course, which would be the mouth. Right? We eat through the mouth and we breathe through the mouth. So it's considered to be part of the skull. It is divided into two sections. We have a cranial part and we have a facial part. All right, so we've got my skull. It doesn't really hold together very well anymore. Oh, it's okay. It's okay.
Can you name your skull?
No, I don't. Horatio, how's that? And if you don't get that, sorry. You do. Okay, so we have the cranial part up here, and we have the facial part here. And it makes sense, right? Our face and our cranium, right? We have two divisions to the skull. There are eight bones here. There are some paired and some single. There are is one frontal bone, forehead. There are two parietal bones. And the best way I always say, the two parietal bones are the oh my God bones. Okay, so they're on either side here. Okay, we have two temporal bones. Think of where your temple is, sort of that temple area. We have one occipital here at the back. We have one sphenoid that sort of represents its outer portion, sort of are within the temporal temple area, but it looks like a butterfly. So if you take the top off your skull and look down in, do you see something inside the skull that looks like a butterfly? Look down from the top. Look in. See a butterfly? No, it's okay. See it? That's the sphenoid. See, if I hold it back here, do you see a full butterfly there? Yeah, see the butterfly now? Yeah. Okay. All right, that is known as the sphenoid. And then another one, called one ethmoid, which is in the back of the nasal area. That's the cranial bones. There are 14 facial bones. There are two nasal bones, which make up the bridge of the nose. There are two maxillae, which make up the upper jaw. There are two zygomatic, which make up part of your cheek bones. There's one mandible, lower part of the jaw. Two palatine, two inferior nasal conchae, these are a bit deeper. One vomer and two lacrimal, they all lie kind of back behind where the eyeballs are, a lot of these bones. But they still make up the facial bones. So we see them all right here in their various colors. You certainly can paint and do whatever you want with yours. We've already talked a bit about these in the syndesmology lecture, and that are the joints of the skull, and we talked about sutures. They are found only in the skull. We talked about their zipper configuration there last week in this fibrous tissue that lies in between the two. So we say it holds the skull together by strong connective tissue in the zipper-like configuration. It's very tight. Again, we talked about that last week, how some say it's a synarthrosis, but there are those who think there is some movement. The new bone sutures are not closed to allow the head to fit through the birth canal, and these are known as fontanelles, and we know them as the soft spots. Anybody here had children and or grandchildren or nephews or nieces, and you felt them when they were really young, and you felt that soft spot in their head? Okay, so they're deliberately there so that head can fit through. Right, we have to birth our offspring very young, right? They're not fully developed because anything otherwise, because of the size of the human pelvis, you would kill mom every time you gave birth to a baby because it would be too large for the coming down the birth canal. So the baby is almost fully developed, but still a long ways to go. And one of these things are these soft spots in the these fontanelles. There are two fontanelles. There is one anterior and one posterior. Both ossify after birth, with the anterior one fully closed at approximately 2 years of age. So it starts quite large, and you know it slowly crystallizes and ossifies and becomes full bone by two. The font where the fontanelle is closed, that will be the front one, is known as the bregma, and the posterior ossifies. It is called the lambda. So we've got the bregma at the front and the lambda at the back. Sutures start ossifying at 20 years, and generally those sutures are completely ossified and solid by the time you're 60. So we sort of see them here a little bit. So let's talk about the first one is the coronal suture. It divides the parietal bones and the frontal bone. It runs from sphenoid to sphenoid laterally. So we see it here in the front again. Now you can start marking your skulls if you want, or name them, or do whatever you want with them. So here we see the coronal suture here. It runs on the coronal plane. Wow. Right? The coronal suture runs on the coronal plane. So it's at the front. It's here at the front between the frontal bone and the two parietals. We see it here as well. The sagittal suture. Oh my God, this is all starting to sound the same. We've taken sagittal too, haven't we? The sagittal suture divides the parietal bones from the coronal suture to the lambdoid suture. And it runs on the sagittal plane. Lo and behold. Okay. So it runs here from the coronal plane down here, right, as we said, to the lambdoid suture, which is the one back here between the occiput and the parietals. So we have the coronal and we have the sagittal. The next is the lambdoid, and it divides the occipital bone from the two parietal bones posteriorly back here. So we're kind of looking a little bit underneath. We're seeing here's the sagittal plane here. Here is the lambdoidal suture right here. Again, you should have all those on your skulls, yes? It's just where they cut off the top. Because if you put the tops back on your skull, you'll see that lambdoid suture comes down deeper than the cut. Yes. See now?
Yes.
The squamous suture is on either side. Now, I'm really happy with the specimens you guys have because they show it. Because traditionally, the previous ones were very poor with that. So you can see on this real model, you can see on either side here, sort of in the temporal area above the cheekbones, you can see these sutures here, right? They're quite obvious. And you've got them there now on yours. As I said, the older models didn't have them. See, it kind of goes all the way around there like that, right? And you have them right there, right? Okay, and this is known as the squamous suture. One on each side divides the temporal bone from the parietal bones. Yes, you do. Oh, and that one? Yeah, it's kind of there, but it's kind of been rubbed away a bit. Yes. See, you need to bring your own. So we see it right here in the red, right along here. Between the pink and the orange, or whatever you call this, fuchsia, whatever. Okay? Peach? Sure. Okay. There is a place where a number of bones all meet in the area what you would consider to be the temple area. When you think of our temple, right? It is considered an important anatomical landmark, and four bones articulate here. The frontal bone, the parietal bone, the temporal bone, and the sphenoid all meet in this pterion. It usually forms an H-shaped, and it is located in that soft spot here in that temporal area, and this is known as the temporal fossa. We don't feel it as a fossa because we've got muscle tissue and skin and so forth, but in this area, and we can see it right here. Here's the H shape here or here. This is known as the temporal fossa, or the pterion. Yep, right there. That's it. Okay? I always ask questions about the pterion. A well-placed strike in this area is devastating. Okay, let's do the cranial bones. First, it's called the frontal bone. It occupies what is known as the supraorbital arches or margin. So this is the bony ridge. Supraorbital means these two ridges where our eyebrows are above our eyes. These are known as the supraorbital margin or arches above the eyes here. So in this area, right here. Some people have them very pronounced and some people don't. So that sort of right above the eye, right in that, right? Now, what's interesting is, from a functional point of view, between the maxilla and the supraorbital arch, you can take an impact in the face and not hit your eye, right? This is where, you know, you can take a strike to the face. And some individuals, this is actually very large. It's quite prominent, depending on each individual. Some people have very prominent ridges above the eyes. This is known as the supraorbital margins. Between these two arches is a round elevation here at this point. You can see right here. So between the two is this elevation. This is known as the glabella. So this so we've got our two arches, and the point between this raised area is known as the glabella. Yes? I've not heard that theory. I think part of it's more protection to impact. The other thing is, when we look at these arches in the skull, there's been a progression of prominence. So Neanderthals, for example, had very prominent ridges. Some of the origins of species of Homo sapiens that we've seen, and going back to Africanus and all those ones, it's been these arches that have been distinctive difference between the various species of bipeds as we've moved through our evolution. So between the arches is the glabella. Now, the frontal bone also forms the roof of the orbits. So although we think of this as the frontal bone, it actually goes under here and forms the roof of the orbits. This is also considered the frontal bone. You can kind of see the lines here. See the line where it kind of borders down in deep in there? The line deep underneath? See way down in there, you can see where it meets. This is all frontal bone, okay? This is all frontal bone. So it's not just the forehead. It comes down underneath. Way down there. See the lines way down there?
Yes.
Okay, this is all frontal bone.
Oh,
okay. I don't know what's like in your models there.
You lose your eyes, you're not straight in the brains.
What's that?
When you lose your eyes, you're not straight in the brains.
You are. It goes right through there. The optical nerve goes right through those two big holes, right into the brain. In fact, I think somebody died that way on Game of Thrones. Didn't they get a...
I'm not sure.
I think they got a well-placed sword right through... You can kind of see it down in there. See the, you see where the sort of the border is down there, way down there.
Well, maybe not where your finger. Yeah, I can see.
Yeah.
You can see a line right along.
See right here,
yeah.
There and there.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's all frontal bone right there.
Okay.
Okay. So it actually comes down underneath and forms the roof of the orbit. Okay. It articulates with the parietal bones of the coronal suture, right? And it also articulates with the zygomatic bone, the lacrimal bone, the ethmoid bone, and the sphenoid bone. And yes, you need to know that. Even though you haven't learned them yet, you will. Right there. The frontal bone articulates with the zygomatic bone, the lacrimal bone, the ethmoid bone, and the sphenoid bone, which we can kind of see here. All right. Whoops, sorry. Wrong way. Okay. Here's the frontal bone here. We can see there's the zygomatic. There's the ethmoid, there's the parietal, there's the sphenoid, okay? Yes. The next are the two, oh my God, bones, the parietal bones. forms the largest area of the walls of the calvaria. Two curved lines are found on its lateral surface known as the superior and the inferior temporal lines. I don't know if they're on here very well. They're really not, but imagine you've got sort of two overriding arches here. Right? See right there? All right, you've got two of them, a superior and inferior lines, temporal lines. The inferior temporal line is important for you to know. It's the attachment for a muscle called temporalis. If you place your hands sort of in the temporal area and clench your teeth, you'll feel temporalis kind of firm up there, right? Well, that upper part of that muscle is the inferior temporal line. The parietal bones articulate with each other at the sagittal suture. The inverted V sutures created by the occipital bone and the parietal bones, as we know, is called the lambdoid suture. Of course, this is where all three articulate, the two parietals and the single occiput, is known as the lambda. The parietal bones also articulate with the temporal bones laterally and the sphenoid bone inferiorly, which we can see here. Here's our parietal bones. Here's where it articulates with the occipital. Here's where it articulates with the temporal, and here's where it articulates with the sphenoid. The two bones form the base of the skull along with the sphenoid, and that's the other thing you need to realize, is that, you know, they kind of help form a little bit of the base of the skull underneath. So we say, The temporal bones form the part of the base of the skull along with the sphenoid. So if we look at the real model here, okay, so we see the outside, right, of the squamous suture, and this represents the temporal bone. It's right here. It forms this part here in the base of the skull. Okay, you've got two sides, right? You've got an outside, you've got an inside, and it helps form the base of the skull that we see in here. Okay, so again, just think of where that temporal bone is, and think behind it on the inside. That's also part of the temporal bone as it comes around. There was a slender pointed process on the inferior external aspect called the styloid process, which serves for a ligament and muscle attachment. Now, I don't know what they're like on this new one. Let me see if it's any good on this one. Oh, yeah, they've done a much better job. You have these two little thin projections here on either side coming down. Okay, these are known as the styloid processes. We find muscles and ligaments that attach there. Yes, those long, long, narrow things that are, okay? These are known as the styloid processes, and they serve as attachment sites. If we think about where those are and we look inferior lateral to the styloid processes, we find two much larger processes known as the mastoid process. And that is this very large one that's very palpable on the lateral aspect here. So if you literally go up the side, just behind your ear, you'll feel that rather large process right there. Yes, that is. No, that's the mastoid. The one, you cannot palpate the styloid. It's too deep. It lies behind all that, so it's not palpable. What you're feeling is the mastoid process. The mastoid process is an important landmark for massage therapists because this is where we find the attachment of sternocleidal mastoid muscle. We spend a lot of time on this muscle as massage therapists, guarantee it. Do you know you're born without one? So babies are born without one. They eventually get one. Any idea when it starts to grow? Yes. The muscle, sternocleidal mastoid, attaches onto the mastoid process. Yes. Yes. When a child is able to lift their head, the tension that's created in SCM or sternocleidal mastoid pulls on this area of the temporal bone, pulling the bone down and creates the mastoid process. Now, it's interesting. It's actually a pneumatic bone. It has a lot of space in it. And back many, many years ago, 1600s, 1700s, before the advent of penicillin, individuals would get mastoiditis and get significant infections in the mastoid process. And because it's direct relationship to the brain, they'd end up with brain infections and die. So we see here the temporal bone here. Right, well, here's our mastoid process here. And we can see the little styloid process kind of down around there. The temporal bones, I said, we're not born with a mastoid process. It comes later. We do have a third process of the temporal bone, and this is known as the zygomatic process, which serves as an attachment site and an articular site. So, again, if you look here at your temporal bone, you'll see this kind of starts part of the cheek right here. This, let me see yours just for a second. You see the little suture right there? Okay, that's a suture. So that's part of the temporal bone. This will be part of the zygomatic bone. That little suture right there. So there's a little suture on it that represents right there. See a little line right there? Okay. It's kind of that one right there, right? That little thin one right there. So that would be the process of the temporal bone up until that line.
Okay.
Everybody see it? Is that yours?
Yes.
It's right there. See the little line right there?
Yeah.
Yep, that would be part of the temporal bone. Okay?
Okay, cool.
All right. Yes, correct. Okay. So this is the zygomatic process, and it articulates to the zygomatic bone. Oh, I just look. I'm like, hey, that's pretty cool. What are you doing? Okay, temporal bone also articulates with the parietal bones, the occipital bone, the sphenoid, and the zygomatics. Now, we saw how that zygomatic process comes off the temporal bone. We then can now say the zygomatic process of the temporal bone articulates with the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. So that line that you looked at on that zygomatic process articulates with the zygomatic process of the
zygomatic bone?
Yes. That front of the cheek area here is a zygomatic bone. So the temporal process of the zygomatic bone articulates with the zygomatic process of the temporal bone to form the cheek. We still have 5 more minutes. You see here in orange, this is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone, and this is the temporal process of the zygomatic bone to form that zygomatic arch, which we think of as the cheekbone. The zygomatic process of the temporal bone articulates with the temporal process of the zygomatic bone to form the zygomatic arch. Sphenoid. So again, you got your skull tops off. You look down in the skull and you see a butterfly, a beautiful butterfly. This butterfly is known as the sphenoid. It is butterfly shaped. It's a key bone in the cranium. In the base of the cranium, it articulates with 8 different bones, right? It takes a large portion of the base of the skull, so it takes a lot of space, and it articulates with the frontal, the parietal, temporal, occipital, the vomer, the zygomatic bone, the palatine, and the ethmoid. So it is kind of the anchor of the base of the skull, so to speak. So we see it here in purple. Now it does expose itself laterally here in the temporal fossa, in purple, but we can see looking at it from underneath, it does represent a lot of the base of the skull. And it's kind of just behind the roof of our mouth. When we go back bone-wise, back behind the roof of our mouth. It's made up of a body and greater and lesser wings. All right, so we can see here, green represents the lesser wing, red represents the greater wing. You can see it there. The lesser wings are more anterior, and the greater wings are posterior. So here's our configuration. The green represents the anterior part of the sphenoid, and the red represents working towards the posterior part of the sphenoid. The lesser wings are anterior. The greater wings are posterior. Sorry? Look in from the top and look at the butterfly. Don't look at that. Look in your skull. Push it away from yourself till you see the butterfly. So anterior, of course, where your nose would be, and posterior would be the back of your head, right?
So that configuration that way.
Yes. No, if you go to the picture,
It's actually because the lesser, see, there's your lesser wings here, and this is your greater wings here.
Oh,
it's actually looking at it that way.
In
between the wings, in between the greater wings is the body of the sphenoid. Okay? So we see the body here in blue. Okay? That is considered the body of the sphenoid. Greater wings are red, lesser wings are green, body is blue. On the body, the superior surface of the body is a configuration that looks a bit like a horse saddle. So you'll see that there's kind of a H shape there. Do you see that? They, when they looked at this way back when they were doing dissections, they thought it looked like a saddle on a horse that the Turks created when they rode horses. So it is called the sella turcica. When you look at it from Latin, it means Turkish saddle. Okay? The sella turcica is very interesting. It forms a fossa. Anybody remember what a fossa is? It's a small depression, right? So if you look down in your sella turcica, you will see there's a depression in there. Yes? No, not there. Right in there. Okay? Right in there. You got it. Right in the center. The deep. Okay? In there. Okay? In there. Okay? Anybody else? Okay? Everybody knows where you're going? Yep. In that spot right there, you find a very important structure called the pituitary gland. It sits in that fossa. Yep, no, right in there. Inside, yep, right in there. Yep. So the pituitary gland actually sits in there. Okay. So we say the teles to sella turcica forms the apophyseal fossa, right, which contains the pituitary gland. The posterior aspect of that fossa is bordered by the dorsum sellae. Well, that makes sense, right? Dorsum means to the back, so it's saying the back part of the saddle, right? Within that fossa is the dorsum sellae. Projecting superior from the fossa are the anterior and posterior clinoid processes, which we see here. Here's our anterior clinoid processes, and here are our posterior clinoid processes. That's why you couldn't stick your finger right in the fossa, because you had these two extensions coming from the back and from the front, right? You see now why you should have your bones with you? It's so much easier if you can look at exactly what I'm talking about. Makes more sense, doesn't it? Yeah. The dorsum sellae, the apophyseal fossa, and the anterior and posterior clinoid processes completely surround and house this pituitary gland. Pituitary gland is a very important part of us. It's where we, when we get to puberty and we're starting to move towards becoming a mature adult, the hormones that take us through puberty till we become the sexually mature human being, then they drive those sorts of things. Growth hormones come from here. All kinds of stuff comes from here. I, unfortunately, my brother's, I guess it would be stepdaughter-in-law, she, about 8-9 months ago, she'd had a child and everything was fine. Well, she started lactating and putting on massive amounts of weight. They couldn't figure what was going on. They discovered she has a pituitary tumor. So they're having to deal with this pituitary tumor through radiation, that kind of stuff. So it's, you can get them. This sella turcica is actually the roof of your paranasal sinuses, kind of, again, up above the roof of your mouth at the back, sort of trying to touch the bottom part of your nose up there. It represents the roof of that where we see. So you can actually, if you take your, you look through the nose here in the back, right? You can see how it kind of forms a bit of the roof when we look at it from down this way. I want to get these cranial bones done, then we'll go. The occipital bone is the last one. It forms the base and posterior aspect of the skull. This is where we find this huge hole. If you look up from underneath, there's a huge hole under there known as the foramen magnum.
right? That represents part of the occipital bone. Much like the frontal bone came down underneath and formed the roof of the orbits, the occipital bone, which represents the back of the head, comes all the way back to here. So if I can just use yours for a second. So, you know, when we massage, when we touch back here, we can kind of get back here. The reality is the occipital bone comes all the way to here. Comes all the way around, forms this foramen magnum, and attaches onto the sphenoid here. Comes all the way around to us. We only touch there. It's all we can touch. Yeah, when we touch. Yep. We call it the occipital region, right, when we touch it. This foramen magnum is where we find the medulla oblongata, which plays a big role on regulation for breathing and heart rate and all those sorts of things, which is part of the lower brain as it translates into the spinal cord. So it's neural tissue. On the inferior surface are two articular processes called the occipital condyles. So we see two bumps here and here on either side of the foramen magnum. These two condyles are where C1 of the cervical spine articulates. In other words, where the head attaches to the spinal column is between these two condyles and the superior surface of cervical spine number 1. So we can see, as I said, it comes all the way around and down here to the sphenoid. It comes quite a way underneath, forms that the larger part of the base of the skull. On the median plane, just superior to the foramen magnum, is a knob-like projection called the external occipital protuberance. It is the point of this protuberance is known as the inion. Have you guys talked about the EOP and the inion yet? Come on, you get in there. Yeah, I get it too. Okay, so we have the external occipital protuberance, which is this bump right here, right in the center. You might have a bit of a bump right here, right? Sort of right there that you might feel on yourself or on others. And the very tip of that EOP is what's called the inion. Okay, so have you palpated this yet in lab, the EOP? Okay, yeah, so it's right here. So the very point is the inion. From the external occipital protuberance, we have nuchal lines that run outward laterally, a superior one and an inferior one. The superior nuchal line is the superior limit of the neck, extends laterally on each side from the protuberance. We find a large number of muscles that find attachment on the superior nuchal line. So it runs from that, again, that protuberance, outwardly, laterally, both sides. Inferior to the superior nuchal line is the inferior nuchal line, which is another area of muscle attachments that we'll eventually get to. We can kind of see it here. Here's the superior and the inferior nuchal lines. You can see splenius capitis, sternocleidomastoid, trapezius, semispinalis, like a lot of muscles attaching here, we're going to learn. Okay, and you can see it there in the purple. There's your occipital condyles there for articulation with C1, and we will see you guys next week.
Don't.